We'll hear argument first this morning in number 85-1043, Pilot Life Insurance Company versus Dedeaux. Mr. Nolan, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the Court. This case involves the issue of federal preemption of state common law claims of general application in the context of ERISA. The real significance of the case is whether or not the federal system of regulation of employee benefit plans as governed by ERISA will now be largely supplanted by the varying state laws that Congress intended ERISA to replace. Congress believed and believes that there are great advantages to ERISA, but those advantages admittedly do not include jury trials, punitive damages, consequential damages, de novo review of claims, decisions, and other features that may be available from time to time under state law. If such state remedies are available, as the Court of Appeals opinion holds, then ERISA will effectively be nullified for all insured plans. Now, this is more than 80% of the health benefit plans in the United States, the vast majority of them. We argue that Congress could never have intended this result and expressly provided against it in ERISA. The focus of this case is an employee benefit plan governed by ERISA and its claims procedure as provided in Section 503 of ERISA. Pilot Life, the petitioner in this case, is the named fiduciary for that plan as provided in ERISA and as designated in the plan itself. And Pilot Life has full responsibility for all claims decisions and claims administration. Mr. Dedeaux, the respondent here, is a participant in that plan, and his claim for benefits was denied by Pilot Life. When it was denied, Mr. Dedeaux did not avail himself of the statutorily mandated claims review procedure in ERISA in Section 503. Instead, he filed suit in the Federal District Court in Mississippi, diversity jurisdiction. He claimed tortious breach of contract, fraud, and breach of fiduciary relationship. He sought disability benefits, consequential damages for mental and emotional distress in the amount of $250,000, and punitive damages in the amount of $500,000. There was a demand for a jury trial, no mention of ERISA in the case. The district court granted summary judgment for defendant. It held that ERISA provided the exclusive remedy. The Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit reversed, holding that Mr. Dedeaux's state common law claims of general application were preserved by the so-called insurance saving clause of ERISA, which keeps from preemption state laws that regulate insurance. Now, we say that that decision is wrong, that Congress, in enacting ERISA, sought to preempt all of the state law that came within the sphere of the statute, that the saving clause is not applicable to state laws like this because they don't regulate insurance, and that in any event, it was plain that Congress sought to prevent the direct application of any state law to an employee benefit plan. In cases like this, which involve federal preemption of state law, this court has said, as it did most recently in California Federal versus Guerra, decided last week, that its sole task is to ascertain the intent of Congress. And to do that, it looks at the language and the legislative history and the structure and purpose of the statute. The key language here is found in Section 514 of ERISA. It's entitled Effect on Other Laws. Section 514A is a sweeping express provision for preemption. It says that ERISA supersedes any and all state laws that may now or hereafter relate to any employee benefit plan. It's followed in 514B by the so-called saving clause, which provides that nothing in ERISA shall exempt any person from any law of any state that regulates insurance. And that clause is immediately followed and modified by the so-called Deamer clause, which provides that no employee benefit plan shall be deemed to be an insurance company or engaged in insurance for purposes of any state law purporting to regulate insurance. Now, there are two things to notice about the language in 514. The first is that when Congress uses the term state law that regulates insurance, it is using a term of art, and in this instance, one that has acquired very specific meaning through years of interpretation under the McCarran-Ferguson Act. The second is that Congress very plainly showed its purpose to prevent any direct regulation of employee benefit plans by state law. That was a finding of this court in the case of Metropolitan Life versus Massachusetts, decided a couple of years ago, where the court said that the purpose of the Deamer Clause is to take out of the operation of the Saving Clause any state laws that apply directly to an employee benefit plan. These state common law claims not only apply directly to the employee benefit plan, but they clash directly with the key provisions of ERISA, with the provisions dealing with fiduciary responsibility, claims review, civil enforcement remedies. These are the core functions of ERISA. They go to the very heart of ERISA regulation, and that's why Congress provided that they couldn't be regulated by state law. The legislative history of ERISA plainly confirms the intent of Congress that the fiduciary standards of ERISA govern the entire claims administration process. That was the finding of this court in MassMutual versus Russell, decided also a couple of years ago. It's in the opinion of the court, and it's very expressly in Justice Brennan's concurring opinion as well. Congress intended that ERISA provide a uniform source of law for evaluating fiduciary standards, that law would apply all over the United States, and that it would provide standards for fiduciaries, and that the federal courts would be used exclusively for cases.
So what was the insurance company's fiduciary duty or position in this case?
In this case, Justice White, the insurance company had the responsibility for claims administration. It also had the insurance policy on
the plan. It sold insurance to the plan, I take it.
It sold insurance to Intex.
But it wasn't a trustee of the plan.
It was acting for the trustee, and that's really the key to the case. It was performing the ERISA function that otherwise would have been provided by the trustee of the plan. It was acting in place of and standing in the shoes of the trustee. It is the named fiduciary under ERISA, and it was provided.
It is the named fiduciary?
It is the named fiduciary under ERISA. To it was delegated the authority to make the decisions involved in claims administration, to confirm or deny claims submitted to it. That's the discretion and that's the function of the named fiduciary. So it's playing the key role.
And under ERISA, how do you get at the claimed breach of fiduciary duty?
At ERISA, under ERISA, you, if you have a case like this, first you go to the claims review procedure provided in 503. When you finish that, you go to 502, which provides what this court has referred to before as the six very careful.
If your claim is denied, well, you can contest it.
If your claim is denied, you can contest it through the procedures provided expressly in the statute.
And what if you think it's just too slow?
Well, our position is that this is the law that Congress provided. I suppose that from time to time...
Was the insurance company under this plan or under the statute required to act within a certain time?
Yes, it is. And if the claims review procedure, for example, is required to be finished in 60 days, and then there may be an additional 60 days, if there has not been action at the end of that time, then the claim is deemed to be denied under regulations provided by the Department of Labor, and then you go into the civil enforcement proceedings. It's a very carefully...
And what is the civil enforcement proceeding, in a court?
The civil enforcement proceeding is in a court, yes. State or federal court for some types of actions.
Well, let's assume you go to civil enforcement proceeding and you win, and the insurance company has breached its fiduciary duty to act in time or in some other way. Then what happens?
Then you get whatever.
You get your claim paid.
You get your claim paid.
With interest, I suppose.
Possibly you get attorney's fees, you get other types of equitable relief.
But you get no remedy against the trustee, against the insurance company.
Well, in this instance, Justice White, the insurance company, Pilot Life, is in effect the trustee.
All right, but you get no other remedy, you just make Pilot Life do what it should have done. Plus attorney's fees.
It is correct that you make Pilot Life do what it should have done. You are not necessarily limited to that remedy.
Well, what else can you get?
Well, you can get all of the civil enforcement rights provided in Section 502.
Well,
you can
recover
other benefits under the plan. You can enforce or clarify
but
your
no
rights.
But no consequential damages.
No consequential damages.
So even if you're not being... Even if you're not getting your money on time has caused you to lose some money or to cost you some money, you can't have any remedy for that.
Well, you can sue to obtain equitable relief specifically under the statute. You can sue to enjoin
well,
the
can
fiduciary.
You get it? Well, I know, but can you get any money?
You can have the fiduciary removed.
Can you get any money, Mr. Nolan?
Yes, you can get money.
In what form?
In whatever form the court to which the application for equitable relief is made finds appropriate.
But if there's a cause of action that's applied to all insurance companies in the state that says that that bad faith or refusal to honor a claim is remediable by some damages or by punitive damages, that state law is inapplicable in ERISA context.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Mr. Nolan, you said that you, in the equitable side of the thing, you could get money. Did I understand that correctly?
Well, I said that you could get money in the context of seeking to obtain equitable relief from the court.
Be more specific.
Well,
I mean, you can get the amount of the claim plus attorney's fees on the law side, I think.
That's correct.
And you say you could remove the trustee in equity.
You can enjoin the trustee. Yeah, you can remove the trustee.
But now I want to know, because I thought you said that the equity side could award you some sort of money damages?
Well, I did not say damages.
Well, what did you mean?
Justice. I meant that an application for equitable relief to the court pursuant to the specific provisions of Section 502 can take whatever form the court in that instance might find appropriate.
Have there been a
variety.
Has there ever been a case where they, under ERISA, and it's been around for a while now, where some insurance company has had to pay a disappointed claimant some money on review?
Well, I think that generally speaking, punitive and consequential damages have not been allowed in ERISA cases by this court or, by and large, by other courts.
That's really what this case is all about.
That is what this case is all about.
Certainly, in a court, an equity never awards punitive damages.
That's correct. The court in equity never does.
There is no prospect of recovery of punitive damages if the state law is preempted. Isn't that correct?
I think that's right, and I think that's the key distinction between state law and federal law here. This was to be achieved by Section 514, the effect on other laws provision, the preemption of state law to allow the federal system to control employee benefit plan regulation. That section is referred to.
Mr. Nolan, I really was puzzled, as the Chief Justice was, about your notion of some other money. Maybe there isn't all this much difference between the federal scheme and the state scheme if there's some general equitable power to give money. I don't know about that myself.
Well, I don't know of
then
a general...
And what section are you referring to when you say that?
I don't know of a general equitable power to give money. I know that this court in Mass Mutual versus Russell, the case that was before it 2 years ago, reserved its judgment about anything more than the specific sections that were involved in that case, and that was the thrust of the concurring opinion. I know that...
You argued that case.
I argued that case, yes, Justice Buck. I know also that the law provides for equitable relief, and I just can't presume to say that that could never include the concept of making someone whole. I think
it
very plainly does not include
damages. What could it be other
than
restitution? I just think this argument strikes me as very strange and almost misleading. I understood that if the federal law preempts, then there are no consequential damages available, there are no punitive damages available, there's no jury trial available, and so on.
That is correct. But there is equitable relief under Section 502, and I don't know what form that would take. I think it's pretty clear that it would not take the form of damages, punitive or consequential.
Punitive damages.
Yes.
Well, Mr. Noel, why isn't it a regulation of insurance if a state, there's a state law that says insurance companies must act promptly on claims. And if they don't, the insureds have remedies. Now, if an insurance company is stuck in violation of that law, if it has to pay some money, it comes out of its pocket, doesn't it? Why is that a regulation of a plan?
Well, I think that in where a plan exists, as it does in this case, the claims administration is provided by the named fiduciary.
Right.
This court has recognized that that whole function is controlled, governed by federal law under ERISA, and the fiduciary standards of that law are applicable.
Well, that may be so. But you think this? Why should a state be preempted from providing a further remedy for a violation of a federal standard?
I guess the clearest answer to that, Justice White, is shown by the circumstances of this case. I believe that it is accurate to say beyond question that if punitive damages are available under state remedies, no participant, no beneficiary, not Mr. Dito nor anyone else, will utilize the provisions of Section 503 of ERISA, which provides for claims review.
Perhaps you could say he has to exhaust those remedies before he can have an independent action.
Well, you could, but his remedies there, I guess, would be viewed as never adequate if he had a shot at punitive damages in a state court. It isn't just that Mr. Dito did this. I think it unmistakably clear that every litigant similarly situated would do it. If that happens, that reduces 503 to a dead letter. It repeals it, in effect.
I suppose it also would raise insurance premiums some substantially.
Well, I think that I think that in ERISA, Congress had that concern, Justice White. I think that it was concerned. These plans are voluntary. Nobody has to set them up. This is a law to provide for a voluntary system that companies will take on individually. So it was intended to be run efficiently and effectively and at low cost.
Does ERISA, Mr. Nolan, require that there be an independent trustee of some sort to administer the plan? MTEX, in this case, couldn't do it itself.
It requires that there be a trustee. The trustee does not have to be independent. INTEX could have done it. INTEX is the plan sponsor and administrator, but has delegated to Pilot Life this key fiduciary role.
Do you have any way of knowing what percentage of the administrators of ERISA plans are insurance companies?
I think that it varies quite a bit. Generally speaking, I think that larger companies do more of it themselves. I think that the insurance companies are most important for medium-sized and small companies where the kind of catastrophic losses that may be available in the plan would be too much for their resources.
I suppose if an employer were a self-insurer, there would be no question of the plan coming under the insurance savings clause.
That's correct. That's correct, and there isn't. There are a myriad of variations. In other words, there are insurance companies that only insure. They fund the plan, but an independent agency, another insurance company, a claims administrator, the plan sponsor, someone else, administers the claim and makes the claims decisions. There are other cases where the insurance company takes on all of the administration, including all of the claims part of it, but does not fund the plan. And so there are all of these varieties.
Mr. Nolan, what was the insurance exception meant to cover? I mean, you painted for us this picture of pristine uniformity, but we have in the statute an exception that seems to indicate that there are some instances where the uniformity will be disrupted. Or otherwise, you wouldn't need the exception.
Yes.
What does the exception cover? Where without it, you'd get a different result.
That is actually the key question, Justice Scalia, and I think that the clearest, most concise statement of that is found in a report of the House Labor Committee. It's dated January 1977. It was referred to and relied on by this court in the Metropolitan Life case, and it goes directly to that point. And the report says, on the one hand, it was clear that the plans subject to ERISA needed to be freed of the possibility of state regulation. On the other, it was important to limit the effect of preemption in order to avoid disrupting state efforts to regulate the conduct of other financial entities not subject to the Federal Act. So I think that really says it about as clearly as it can be said. Congress
Do you need an exception for that?
Excuse me?
Would you need an exception for that? I mean, what kind of thing that arguably would have been covered by the statute has been accepted from it by this provision? Or is it just a better make doubly sure kind of an exception?
I guess it could have been.
I tend to think exceptions are in there because without them, something different
yes.
would happen.
Yes.
What
I think you're right, Justice Scalia, that it could have been done either way, and perhaps the reason that it was done this way in this instance is the McCarran-Ferguson Act and the tradition of insurance regulation that that follows from it and Congress's awareness of that. But as far as the purpose of Congress is concerned, there isn't anything in the legislative history that is inconsistent with the paragraph that I just read from the report.
All I'm asking for is an example of a case that would come out differently had the exception not been in the statute.
Well, I guess the I'm not sure Metropolitan Life satisfies that, but I think it probably comes pretty close to it. Any of those, Metropolitan Life was a case that involved a mandated benefits law of the state of Massachusetts, and it's exemplary, I think, of the principle of what we're talking about here. Anything that the state says, you have to put that in your policy. All of the regulation of insurance companies. I've read several law review articles in this subject in the course of preparing for this case, and the emphasis on insurance regulation is on 1,000 different regulatory features having to do with financial soundness and licensing and the selling of insurance and what the content of the policies and so on. You don't get to a question like this until you get into the operation of ERISA. In this instance, until you get into the claims approval procedure. So all of those cases in point of time back of where we are would be regulated by state insurance law.
Metropolitan Life really supports you here.
Yes, I think it very clearly does, Justice White, because it defines the Deamer Clause, not a clause which is necessarily self-evident on its meaning on first reading. But the court in Metropolitan said that the Deamer Clause takes out of the saving clause state insurance laws when they apply directly to employee benefit plans.
Well, Mr. Nolan, don't you think we'd have to cut back a bit on some of the language in that Metropolitan Life case for you to prevail here?
For us to prevail, no, Justice O'Connor, I don't. I think that the case is great for us because it does define the Deamer Clause. It says, the court says, we're not going to limit the Deamer Clause any further than Congress has limited it in the clause itself. And that's the court says we're not going to limit the insurance saving clause any more than Congress has limited it in the clause itself and in the Deamer Clause. And that's good enough for us. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Very well, Mr. Nolan. We'll hear from you, Mr. Walker.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. Petitioner says that this is a case in which congressional intent is to be discerned, and I agree. Fortunately and rarely, in this particular case, Congress has expressly stated in the saving clause itself its intent. Its intent to save from preemption. State laws which regulate insurance. We don't have to look anywhere else. And indeed, it says it in the language of statutory construction. It says, don't construe any other provision in this whole ERISA as exempting or relieving any person from state laws.
Which law of the state, actually, right?
From the law of any state, you're right, which regulates insurance. Now, the distinction between law of any state and state laws, I think, is one that was made in petitioner's brief, but which was rejected as not significant in the brief of the United States. This court used the term state law in describing the preemptive effect in the Metropolitan Life decision. But the legislative history also says it. And it uses the term state law. And indeed, of course, the presumption is against preemption. And indeed, Section 514b2 says nothing in ERISA shall be construed. That includes 514c, which has the definition and in which the slight change in language is present. So,
that said that insurance companies will act on a claim within a week, 7 days, and the state said this includes insurance companies who insure ERISA plans, that would be the controlling time limit.
Yes, sir, it certainly would be.
And despite what the plan said.
Yes, sir, that's certainly true, and the important thing about that is that's the distinction that the Deamer Clause makes. Uh-huh. If that same regulation purported to regulate plans mm-hmm. by calling plans insurance companies.
No, it wouldn't work. No. Well, or the state says the insurance company shall have 30 days to act, and the plan says 15 days. The state law would control.
Absolutely, if it's an insured plan. And that's the distinction.
Yes,
the distinction is between insured and self-insured plans. Mm-hmm. And the reason is...
And so it wouldn't make a bit of difference what the plan said in terms of the time or the procedure.
Absolutely.
And that if the state law could say if you don't act within 30 days, you're in court.
Yes, sir.
You can disregard all the appellate procedures a plan might provide.
Yes, sir.
Well, Mr. Walker, I think that we have to focus on the Deamer Clause because whatever's covered by the Deamer Clause is removed from the Savings Clause, if you will, that you're relying on. So we have to know whether the Deamer Clause extends to a trust established under a plan, whether or not the trustee is the insurance company that happens to be serving to insure that ERISA plan. And if anything at all seems clear from the history, the congressional and legislative history of ERISA, it would seem to be that remedies provided for employees covered by an ERISA plan, whether insured or not, are limited to those spelled out in the legislation. And so I think there a very logical argument can be made and is being made that the Deamer Clause backs out of the Savings Clause at least the remedies provided for an insured employee.
Your Honor, that's certainly the argument petitioner is making. In doing so, petitioner is failing to look at the precise language of the Deamer Clause, which says expressly that no plan or trustee shall be deemed to be an insurance company or in the business of insurance. In other words, the Deamer Clause comes in to limit the Savings Clause. The Savings Clause says...
Well, it says, for purposes of any law of any state purporting to regulate insurance companies.
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. But the Deamer Clause only limits the Savings Clause, and the distinction has been made by this Court in the Metropolitan Life decision between direct and indirect regulation of plans. This Court has said that regulating an insurance company in an insurance-funded plan may, in fact, cause some consequences on the plan. But that's okay, because Congress has said so, and we're not in a position to decide Congress was wrong.
Well, that's why I asked Mr. Nolan if he didn't think you had to cut back on some of the language in that Russell case. He thought not, but I think there's some difficulty.
Yes, Your Honor. In the Metropolitan Life case, I think you absolutely do have to cut back on the language if you don't find for us. What the insurance companies want in this case, of course, is no regulation at all. They choose state regulation in the McCarran-Ferguson Act because federal regulation is serious under the antitrust laws. They now see that state regulation and the developing common law of bad faith is serious, and they'll have to do what they promised to do and pay claims that they owe and not cheat their insureds. And so they say, wait a minute, ERISA's designed to take care of this. I submit that Congress has made this intent clear, and if the insurance companies want to take this up with somebody, they ought to take it up with Congress.
Well, do you really think that Congress intended to allow the very detailed civil enforcement procedures for an employee covered by an ERISA plan to be completely bypassed at the plaintiff's option?
In the case of insured plans, I do, because Congress says so in the saving clause. It saves insurance regulation.
But it may have backed out of that in the Deamer clause. That's the problem.
I don't think they backed out of it under the Deamer clause. In the Deamer clause, all that's said is you cannot sneakily regulate a plan by calling it insurance. We're not calling it insurance. Now, there's a difference that ought to be drawn, and notice here between administrative services. An insurance company can wear two different hats. It can simply come in and perform administrative services, and that's all it does. If it does that, it's not an insured plan. And if it's not an insured plan, all of ERISA, including the specific enforcement remedies, applies. If, on the other hand, it wore only the hat of insurance company selling a policy to an insured, then it would be clear we wouldn't have that problem of civil enforcement.
Mr. Walker, if what you say is true, if that interpretation is correct, there is a severe disadvantage in having an insurance company act as trustee under the plan. Right? I mean, an enormous disadvantage. Is there any indication in the legislative history or any reason why Congress would have wanted to create that disadvantage?
First of all, the insurance companies don't usually act as trustees. They act as plan administrators, but there's still a serious disadvantage on that point.
Right.
And the disadvantage does not apply if that's all they act as. In other words, the only disadvantage applies if they sell insurance policies. And that's because state law controls that.
Only if they're insurance companies. Yes, what I'm saying. Is there any indication that Congress, for some reason, didn't want insurance companies to act as administrators? Because that's going to be the result of what you're saying. And nobody in his right mind is going to have an insurance company act as administrator. The fees are going to go up so much that it'll make it impossible.
No, excuse me.
Self-insurers, they can't handle it. So the disadvantage is going to devolve on the smaller companies who either buy insurance or they won't have their plan.
First of all, if they only act as administrators, there's no problem. It's only when they sell insurance. You're exactly right, Mr.
Well, why do you say that? Why do you say that?
They're not insurance companies if they don't sell insurance, right?
Well, they may be insurance companies for other purposes, but plenty of them perform administrative services only now.
I don't understand your position. If you have an insurance company that administers a plan for, say, General Motors, which self-insures the payments and liability.
Yes, sir.
Wouldn't you have your state law cause of action in that case?
No, sir. And the reason is the Metropolitan Life case makes clear that in the case of self-insured plans, self-funded plans, the savings clause does not apply because the Deamer clause eats it up.
Yeah, but even if the state law required, even if the state law required an insurance company which administers all sorts of insurance to avoid bad faith denials of benefits and all the rest?
Would not apply.
Would not apply.
The difference, and this distinction is made in the Metropolitan decision.
Well, Mr. Walker, do you happen to know what percentage of all employees covered by ERISA plans are covered by insurance company benefits as opposed to self-insured?
No, ma'am. There's some statistics that are offered by the petitioner in the United States in their briefs. Obviously, it's a lot of them because of the interest that's been drawn by the insurance industry. I do think that it will have a consequence. The consequence will be that the beneficiaries of these plans, the small plans, will get state law protection when that state has decided that it's important to have claims paid. ERISA, after all, was not drafted to protect insurance industries.
No, but it was partly drafted to encourage small companies to have such plans, and maybe some will decide it's too expensive.
And also to have some uniformity in the administration of these plans, these plans, which a lot of them cross several state lines, and you have a great confusion of state law.
Yes, so the conflicting policies which this court recognized in Metropolitan Life and said, leave it to Congress. Congress drafted the statute in which these two policies go different directions.
Mr. Walker, do you know of any company that's big enough to be a self-insurer, which and yet calls in an insurance company just to administer the plan?
Yes, sir. I've
are there some that do that?
Cases like that. Penrod does it, for example. Mm-hmm. They use Life Insurance Company of the Southwest to perform administrative services only. Borden's uses Metropolitan to perform administrative services only. I mean, I've experienced that. As to the cost, I don't understand exactly why insurance companies say if we're forced to pay punitive damages when we cheat our insureds, we're going to have to raise rates. That's what bad faith is about. That's like Las Vegas saying that if we're going to have a square
well,
table.
That's a great argument in theory, but if an insurance company has lost money on its ERISA business for the last two or three years, I can't believe that they aren't going to raise their rates.
Well, Your Honor, if they choose to do so, let them come to Congress and get an amendment to this statute and provide the information.
Well, that's
they refuse to do that.
Certainly is an argument.
Across the board, they refuse to provide information about these losses they claim. If they want it, let them come to Congress instead of this court, which is not a body that's specifically designed to take care of it.
But the question we're considering now is whether Congress, in enacting ERISA with the various preemption savings clause, contemplated the sort of system that you're urging it did.
Well, I'm not sure what Congress contemplated, except I know what Congress said, and Congress said that insurance regulation is saved, and it said it broadly, and this court has agreed and read the statute and refused to limit it beyond what Congress has done. And Congress has had an opportunity to change that, as this court pointed out in Metropolitan, and yet it's not done so.
Well, do you have any reason to dispute the government's figures and the Department of Labor study that 91% of health plans covering fewer than 100 employees are insured plans and that 83% of those with over 100 employees are insured plans?
I'm sure those figures were accurate at the time, about 1980. Mm-hmm. And my personal experience has been that insurance companies are already changing over to administrative services only, at least in the large companies, and that may have changed somewhat. I don't know.
That would certainly be the trend.
Yes, sir.
If you win.
Yes, sir. And of course, if this court decided, which it has not clearly decided, the question of punitive damages under ERISA. In the Russell case, of course, it's been pointed out that that was reserved. And while there's been a suggestion made that courts of equity may not award punitive damages, in Mississippi they may. And I think generally they may, although I'm not sure they would award them for breach of trust quite in this context. But if this court decided to allow punitive damages to protect plan beneficiaries, the people ERISA was designed to protect, then insurance companies would all of a sudden be reading the savings clause very differently, because that's what this is about. The question of whether insurance companies are going to be made to pay what they already promised to pay in the first place, or whether they're going to be able to be outside the law altogether.
Well, under ERISA, you can sue an insurance company and make it pay what it promised to pay in the first place. What you want it to pay is a lot of consequential damages that might have resulted from its failure to pay what it promised to pay.
Yes, sir. I want them to pay what they owe before somebody sues them. I want them to know that if they don't go ahead and pay and live up to their obligations, they'll have to pay more later. If the most they'll have to pay is what they owed anyway, and if a litigant has got to hire an attorney, and by the way, attorney's fees are not automatic under ERISA. It's within the judge's discretion on whether the plaintiff's attorney even gets attorney's fees. I want them to have to treat their insureds fairly from the beginning. Mississippi bad faith law.
Mr. Walker, yes. You say insurance companies are saved. Insurance companies were also saved in the McCarran-Ferguson Act.
Yes, sir.
But Congress did not save anything except legislation governing insurance companies there, right?
Yes, sir. I agree with you.
Now, when
although that statute, I think some of this court's decisions has suggested that that includes at least administrative regulation in addition to legislation, and of course the ERISA provision.
But surely not decisional law.
The court has not expressly said that. It hadn't expressly not said it.
Oh, you think McCarran-Ferguson may cover decisional?
It may cover decisional law, but I don't think that that's important for this case. I think this case has ERISA, which very expressly deals with the problem and makes clear in the statute itself that decisional law is included.
Well, you think Congress's concern for state authority over insurance in one act is totally unrelated to Congress's concern for state authority over insurance in another one?
No, sir. I think in both cases,
Congress.
Do you think
they both have the same scope?
I'm not sure they have exactly the same scope. I think in both cases, Congress was trying its best to allow insurance companies to avoid federal regulation and to live where they were happy to live in the various states. Now the insurance companies aren't happy there because of bad faith, and they're trying to come back under the umbrella of ERISA. Now, I do think that the McCarran-Ferguson Act and the saving and the regulation of insurance question is certainly related, as this court has said in Metropolitan Life, to the questions here in ERISA. But I think it comes down the same way. As this court said in the
But the language here is ambiguous. If you assume that the definition of law of any state is not necessarily the same as the definition contained in the Act of State Laws. And it's not the same phrase. So in this act, it's at least ambiguous. And in McCarran-Ferguson, it's pretty clear, it seems to me, that it doesn't cover decisional law because it refers there to any law enacted by any state. And it says, unless such act specifically relates to the business.
Well, there's
pretty clear in McCarran-Ferguson that it relates to legislation and perhaps implementing regulation. So if the two have to be construed in pari materia, I think you're going to lose on that point.
Your Honor, I don't think so because there's a presumption against preemption. And to use the strained distinction between any law of any state and state law, I believe there is a presumption against, you all said in Metropolitan Life that there was a presumption against preemption and use that language in interpreting the savings clause. And I think that if any presumption against preemption is applied, certainly this kind of what I would view as a strained construction, this distinction should not be drawn.
Mm-hmm.
Your Honor, I don't know. This
a lot of plans are, aren't they, the result of collective bargaining?
As far as I know, it was not. I don't know. I don't think that's part of the record anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And this case was brought at a time when nobody much knew ERISA was around, neither the plaintiff nor the defendant. The defendant found out about it a couple of years later and amended its answer. And I'm not sure about that. Well, Mississippi bad faith law, and indeed any common law of general application, although Mississippi bad faith law specifically focuses on insurance and thus does not fall within that argument that's made, an argument that I don't accept by the petitioners, certainly is designed to focus upon the insurance industry, to force the insurance industry to do what it ought to do, and to protect the people that ERISA is designed to protect. Happily, it does that as well. Since it is a state law which regulates insurance, since this court has said that that's where the inquiry stops, since in its reply brief, petitioner has almost admitted that even if it is a state law which regulates insurance, they still win, the language in the Metropolitan case, correctly decided in my view, of course, is that that's where the inquiry stops. This is state law which regulates insurance. It is therefore saved from preemption. This is an insured rather than an uninsured plan.
Any state law of general applicability regulates insurance, right?
Yes, sir.
If we apply your first principle of presumption against preemption, then I guess we'd have to say that all state laws of general applicability continue to apply.
Yes, sir.
So long as they're being applied to insurance companies.
To regulate it. And, of course, as Dean Keaton has said in his footnote in the U.S. brief points out, that's the way insurance is basically regulated, through court decision which interprets meanings of policies.
What about the Mississippi statute of frauds? Would that apply? Would that be something that wasn't preempted?
I think, first of all, the Mississippi statute of frauds might not relate to the plan in the first place. In other words, it might not fit under 514A in the beginning.
Well, but what if it did?
Since if some special wrinkle developed to deal with insurance policies, I would say it did.
Well, supposing it's just a general statute of frauds, it doesn't have any provision in it about insurance, but it just applies to all written contracts. The argument is this is a written contract.
In this case, it regulates an insurance company because the insurance company is one of the parties.
Well, you asked me to make some assumptions that are not correct, but for purposes of argument, I would say that a law of general application, first of all, if it's that general, is not going to relate to the plan. Secondly,
I don't understand why.
Because it's got to focus on the plan in some way whatsoever, some manner, to relate to the plan. I'm not really prepared.
I mean, by its terms, but the law by its terms has to refer to plans?
No, sir. To fit under 514A, it doesn't take too much. And, of course, since that's not the issue in this case, since we've admitted that what we've got fits under 514A, I can't point out the nuances to you. But a law of general application that applies equally, then perhaps there's no reason to view it as insurance regulation. But a law of general application, to simply use that phrase, general application, when in fact it's applied to the insurance industry or insurance contracts or insurance claims handling in a specific way, then that regulates insurance. And all insurance teachers agree that it regulates insurance. And all insurance industry agrees as well that it regulates insurance.
What if Mississippi law didn't focus particularly on an insurance company's duty to pay, but just say that any debtor's duty to pay, you could have a breach of good faith and recover punitive damages for the failure of a debt to pay the debtor to pay the debt on time?
All right. First of all, let me make clear that petitioner's argument in its reply brief that any intentional refusal to pay a contract justifies punitive damages is clearly contrary to Mississippi law, contrary to Oliver Wendell Holmes, contrary to the Restatement Second of Contracts, Section 355. So that's not the general law. But assuming that it were, if it is not applied directly or in any way more significantly toward insurance companies than anything else, then I don't think
applies to them more often than anybody else, probably, just because they happen to pay more claims than anybody else, or to be liable to pay more claims than anybody else.
Is that even though that were true, by terms, the doctrine applied to any debtor?
Well, let's put it this way. We do have the rule that says any debtor is supposed to pay his debt. Okay? And if he doesn't, he's got to pay damages. And that's the general contract rule that was modified in the Veal case in which the court applied it in Mississippi law for insurance companies. That's not a law which specifically focuses on insurance. It has not been applied more directly toward insurance than anything else, as far as I can tell, based on that narrow hypothesis. And I don't think that it would be saved. Frankly, I don't think it would be necessary for it to be saved.
Where do you get that limitation out of the statute, that it has to relate more narrowly to insurance companies?
It says insurance regulation. In other words, it says state laws which regulate insurance. The word regulate probably means something. And the question is, what precisely does it mean? It clearly includes a state law that's designed to force insurance companies to pay legitimate claims. The question is, does it include
general state law saying everybody shall pay his debts applies to insurance companies? Surely that regulates insurance.
It certainly may.
Regulates them and everybody else.
It certainly may do that.
But you're giving it a narrower interpretation because it would frankly seem somewhat absurd to give it
No, sir. Absolutely not. It doesn't seem absurd
to
me.
Well, then your general principle of construe everything to avoid preemption ought to I would have thought you would have answered the Chief Justice's question entirely differently, saying, yes, it covers all state laws. I don't know how else your principle would play out in this case. Or otherwise, you're not being loyal to your principle, and you know, once you acknowledge that, then we have to start drawing lines. And I don't know why we should draw the line where you want us to, between somehow applying specially to insurance companies and not applying specially, why we should draw it there rather than between, as McCarran-Ferguson did, between statutory regulation and non-statutory regulation or some other fashion.
The reason I'm having difficulty, I believe, is because the hypothesis is one that I think will be taken care of by never even coming up because of it not relating sufficiently to the plan in the first place under 514A. But assuming that it does, I agree with you. There is no reason in principle to draw a distinction if it has the effect of regulating. And if that's the decision that this court wants to make, that if it has the effect of regulating, fine.
I think that's a more, what should I say, consistent position.
This case involves state law regulating insurance. It involves state law that was expressly, clearly preserved by Congress in the statute itself. The Fifth Circuit correctly construed this court's opinion in Metropolitan Life, in recognizing that such state law was saved from preemption. And we request the court to affirm the Fifth Circuit.
Thank you, Mr. Walker. Mr. Nolan, you have 3 minutes remaining.
Just a few points, if the court please. First, to respond to the Chief Justice's comment about what did Congress contemplate. I think that's very important. I think that's really what we're doing here. What Congress contemplated is repeated over and over and over again in the legislative history. They contemplated a uniform system of federal regulation of employee benefit plans. There is, by stark contrast, not a single reference any place in the legislative history to preservation of any kind of a state cause of action like this. That's very significant. The legislative history of ERISA runs 15 volumes.
Well, that silence may run the other way.
Well, I think the silence, Justice White, runs toward the uniformity that you commented on earlier. And that's what Congress was thinking of. It's inconceivable that Congress, in a legislative history that extensive, could make a major exception to what it was providing in the statute and make no reference to it.
You might expect somebody to say that state causes of action are preempted.
Well, there are references to state causes of action in a lot of other statutes, you know, Justice White, from the Silkwood case. As this court knows from Title VII and so on, there are a lot of different ways to do it, but none of those ways took place here. The definition of employee benefit plan very specifically includes plans funded through the purchase of insurance or otherwise. That's definitional in the statute. It isn't that Congress provided one statute for insured plans and another for self-insured plans. Employee benefit plans are defined as plans that provide benefits through the purchase of insurance or otherwise.
Mr. Nolan, where do you draw the line that I was just discussing with Mr. Walker? You draw it between statute and non-statute. How do we know when it's a law regulating insurance?
We would draw the line, Justice Scalia, on the function. And we think, what function is the actor, insurance company in this instance, performing? If it is performing a compulsorily, an ERISA-mandated function, in this instance, claims administration, we would say that that was ERISA and preemption apply.
Well, then the insurance company doesn't have to keep a certain reserve?
All of that is regulated by state law. That doesn't really rise to the level of an ERISA.
No, but as far as his ERISA function is concerned, he's insuring under ERISA. Doesn't he have to comply with the state law requiring insurance companies?
He does. Insurance companies, for all of those kinds of considerations, comply with state law. You don't get to an issue like this until you get into the administration of an employee benefit plan. And this function reaches into the very vitals of that administration.
Thank you, Mr. Nolan. The case is submitted. We'll hear argument next.